This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
A job may not be all about the money, but getting paid adequately, on time, and in accordance to what's stipulated on your contract, it's important. In fact, it's the law. Yet, so many media organisations have shirked their responsibility in ensuring their journos are paid adequately and on time.
There have been so many retrenchments of late, media companies closing down. Not all give their staff the severance packages they rightly deserve. Which got us thinking. While journalists are busy fighting for their right to report freely, without fear or favour, is there anyone looking out for their basic rights as employees?
BFM 89.9, good morning, I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Bahardin.
This is In Case You Missed It. This week we explore the rights of journalists in Malaysia when practicing.
But before that, we have a couple of stories from Asia Calling. India hosts an urban street art festival, and Vietnam attempts to find a solution to food wastage.
India's capital, New Delhi, is playing host to an urban street art festival where local and international street artists gather with a mission to transform the city's landscape. The organisers are using Delhi's footpaths and walls as a platform for artistic expression in a move to make art accessible to everyone. Bismillah Gilani speaks to the artists.
The Inland Container Depot on the outskirts of Delhi is Asia's largest dry port. Usually buzzing with the honks and squeals of moving vehicles, the surroundings these days are much calmer. The port has been turned into a venue for the Delhi Street Art Festival, and dozens of artists are at work amid a backdrop of live music and dance performances. Akshat Norial is co-founder of the Start India Foundation, the group organizing the festival.
Our foundation is a not-for-profit foundation, and we work in public art. Ours
is a not-for-profit group, and through this festival, we are trying to take artworks out of the conventional galleries and enclosed spaces to make it available to a wider audience. In India, enjoying artworks is thought to be only for the elite or people from upper middle class. What we are trying to do is to democratize art and make it accessible to everyone.
This is the fourth edition of the Street Art Festival. And each time, the organizers get creative. This year, they are using shipping containers as the canvas, an idea that has struck an emotional chord with both local and foreign artists. French artist Sowat sees it as a homecoming of the street art.
Graffiti was born on trains. Yeah. It was always the idea of having rolling museums, you know, and painting your work somewhere and having it travel throughout the city or throughout the country. So that's what I think is the most exciting. Who knows where the hell this container is going to end up? You know, who knows who is going to see it? That's why I think it's even bigger than street art, because those containers are going to travel through the country and they're not even going to be seen by people from the urban spaces. They're going to be, I hope, they're going to be seen by people that live in the countryside.
The visitors too are equally excited, seeing the containers with beautiful artworks. Abhilash Khandekar is a senior journalist. He covers art for one of India's leading newspapers.
Delhi being what it is, Delhi has been a center of international art. There have been a lot of museums, art galleries, but this something is really, really very good. Containers being used for as art walls is something really new and different. This is a wonderful exposure for me. And I'm amazed and I'm really, very happy to be here.
Some of the artworks that stand out include a massive mural of an astronaut staring into space, an Indian goddess riding a dragon, and a wall painted with the word breathe, using a special black ink made from particulate matter and carbon, emphasizing the urgent need for clean air. Local artist Harish Raman has used a vibrant palette of colors to create a mural of what he describes as the god of street art.
In India, there's a god for everything, yeah? But there's no god for street art. So I thought that it would be interesting to explore that idea of kind of creating some kind of a deity for street art and creating some kind of a movable shrine.
But Gaia, a street artist and muralist from the United States, is more concerned with global warming.
So what you have here is the Alto Matsuri Suzuki car in repeat, and they're superimposed over half of a gigantic globe. And then you have eventually, it has not yet been completed, but a portrait of a man named Malcolm McLean. And he is credited with really innovating the container and bringing it to a level where it could in fact be standardized and utilized by all sorts of shipping companies beyond Sealand.
By including one of India's top-selling cars in his painting, Gaia is trying to bring attention to the relationship between urban living and global warming.
So what I'm saying is that simply traditional lifestyles are being urbanized all over the world. We're seeing the advent of the mega city. And so as you have the sort of the pooling of labor from the countryside into the city and the exploitation of the traditional lifestyle, and that of course creates a tendency or a need or a want or a desire to also be able to have the comforts and the conveniences of access to medication, access to clean water, but of course also access to cars and your own vehicle and your own spatial autonomy.
Among other works, a portrait of the late Iranian poet and activist Farooq Farrokhzad by Iranian artist Nafir signifies the importance of the struggle for women's rights in conservative societies. As part of the festival, the organizers have joined hands with the local government to convert a residential area in Delhi into what is being called the country's first art district. Magnificent wall murals with local and international artists are transforming Delhi's Lodhi colony, an area of historical and architectural significance, into an open-air art gallery. From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
Art in general is such a powerful thing. Paintings, music, plays, poetry, all of it can stir emotions. But the unique thing about street art is how open the canvas is. You will be forced to reflect on social or political issues depicted in the artwork.
True. For me, I'm more captivated when the founders said that they want to democratize art. In a way, that is the problem with arts, I feel. It's either too highbrow or too abstract for the public to appreciate and digest. Accessibility is also another problem, which is why bringing it to the streets is a really good move.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
Yeah. In Shah Alam, there's a place called Laman Seni. It's in Section 7, and they did the exact same thing there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They transformed one of the back alleys to a street art gallery, and they got the students from the local universities there to work on it. The result is quite stunning, Cheryl. It benefits the students because now they have a huge canvas to express themselves and be appreciated by the public.
Well, you and I are going to have to take a little road trip to Shah Alam, isn't it?
Yep. Let's go. Roughly one-third of the food produced in the world for human consumption is wasted every year. According to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, approximately 1.3 billion tons of food gets lost or wasted. So, how can we humans be less wasteful? This question has become increasingly relevant as we start to consider the sustainability of food. In Ho Chi Minh City, Lian Huang speaks to some experts from across the region to find out more.
Here's an idea. If you want to look healthy and pretty, what you need is chicken. Not to eat, but to rub on your skin. Sort of. A team of Malaysian scholars has been trying to find a use for chicken skin. Apparently, it contains a lot of elastin, which is similar to collagen and can be turned into beauty products, like anti-aging lotion or drinks or cosmetics.
So we're actually exploring the idea of ways to convert the waste poultry skin into a highly valuable product called elastin.
Salma Mohammed Yusuf is part of the team. She is a senior lecturer at the National University of Malaysia's School of Chemical Sciences and Food Technology. And she has a nice little catchphrase for her scientific experiments.
Yeah, it's creating wealth from waste.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Wealth from waste. That could be the slogan for a whole group of people who are now trying to make the whole food cycle more efficient. Do you ever look at your trash can and feel kind of guilty for throwing out food? I do. So I always find it cool when I hear about new ways people are trying to prevent that, to minimize waste. Like chicken, it's gotta be one of the most popular foods in the world. But a lot of the bird gets tossed out before ever reaching a dinner plate.
Our consumer is already, and now it's becoming more health concerned. So they associate the poultry skin with cardiovascular disease, you know. So that contributes to the poultry skin being discarded like everyday basis.
So Malaysians would not eat the skin as much.
Now, not only at the consumer levels, at the food service and industrial levels too. So we can see in the market there's lots of skinless section, you know, skinless chicken section. So
Salmo's project had funding from the Malaysian government, and other countries are getting involved too. Just this year, France became the first nation to ban supermarkets from trashing food that hasn't gone bad yet. In Denmark, a new store called We Food recently started selling products past their expiration dates.
So, by the way, my name is Len Marvin Gonzalez from Philippines. Together with me is my advisor, Mr. Antonio.
Then there's the Philippines. I met Leif Marvin Gonzalez, a research coordinator at Capiz State University's College of Agriculture and Fisheries. He and his team noticed that so much cabbage was being lost from the time a farmer harvested it to the time it was sold to Filipino shoppers. So they tested out different techniques to minimize this waste.
So based on the result of the study, so it is shown there that most of the in terms of post-harvest loss from farmers, so it is less reduced into almost 5 to 10%.
So you were able to prevent 5 to 10% of the loss.
Yeah. So based on the study, so I was able to reduce the loss from farm up to retail level.
How did they do it? The researchers had four methods. They kept the outer leaves on the cabbage to protect it. They transported the vegetables in plastic crates instead of sacks. They mixed aluminum with water and spread it on the cabbage to control bacteria. And finally, they used plastic film to reduce the crop's exposure to oxygen. Gonzalez and Salma both talked to me at the recent International Conference on Environment and Renewable Energy in Ho Chi Minh City. It was hosted by the Asia-Pacific Chemical, Biological, and Environmental Engineering Society. While I was there, I also chatted with Hiroko Seki, a postdoctoral fellow at Tokyo University of Marine Science and Technology. She conducted tests to compare the use of styrofoam versus cardboard when transporting tuna. And she found that cardboard is cheaper during the manufacturing and transit phases. Plus, it decomposes, so it's better for the environment.
The water resistant corrugated cardboard.
I caught up with Suki during the conference lunch break, and she told me researchers are working on a prototype of corrugated cardboard that will survive in the water. Suki says the development could significantly reduce waste in seafood logistics in the future. Biodegradable materials like cardboard are better for the environment. And so is minimizing waste. Gonzalez, the Filipino researcher who focused on cabbage, says there are other benefits to reducing waste as well.
So we must adapt this technology, particularly farmers, the retailers, wholesalers, and as well as consumers, so that we can we're able to increase our profit.
Increase the profit.
Profit, yeah, and also the production. Since we're aiming for self-sufficiency as well as
food security.
Food security, yeah, so the Philippines security. Wants to make sure it can feed itself.
Yep.
As for the rest of us, advocates say everyone can waste less food, which would reduce a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. A few things we can do: not overspend at the grocery store, or obsess too much about having perfectly shaped apples or carrots. For Asia Calling, this is Lian Huang, keeping an eye on my trash can and reporting from Ho Chi Minh City.
A little part of me thinks that food wastage is a problem for the privileged.
That is true.
Especially if you want to compare the situation we're in to the less developed nations, right?
Mm-hmm.
But pragmatically speaking, this is a real problem for us. It's bound to happen when we gain the ability to produce. Supply has to keep up with our erratic demand, especially when you think of how gluttonous people can be.
Yep.
For me, the change should start at home. Let's teach our kids to eat moderately and clear their plates whenever they have a meal.
You know, Hanif, you make an excellent point, because just a few days ago, there was a news report about how Malaysians waste 15,000 tons of food daily, including 3,000 tons that are still fit for consumption. Personally, I think the wastage comes from greed. We Malaysians, we're obsessed with food. And most Malaysians waste food, especially during festive occasions. Now, that's something to think about. Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. After the break, we explore journalists' rights with regard to their welfare when employed.
All that in a minute.
I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is In Case You Missed It. I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
The media plays a crucial role in providing factual reporting and disseminating information to the public. If you were to equate a media organisation to a football team, journalists will be the players serving the team by putting their best foot forward and making sure the team reaches its end goal.
Of course, that comes with its own sets of challenges. Media freedom has always been what journalists aspire to, but it will always remain in that distant horizon. Journals need a solid support system to look out for their basic needs while they try their very best to reach that.
Unfortunately, there is an inadequacy when it comes to a solid support system in the form of basic welfare protection. Media organisations, consciously or otherwise, sometimes neglect their basic duties to their employees. As a result, we hear cases of unfair retrenchment, unpaid salaries, and many other basic violations to employees' rights.
So, who is actually looking after our journalists when cases like these happen? Like many other vocation, journalists do have a union that looks after them. In Malaysia, that is the duty of the National Union of Journalists.
I spoke to Chin Sung Chiu, the president of the National Union of Journalists Peninsula Malaysia, to learn more about their role and the plight journalists sometimes find themselves in.
NUJ is one of the trade unions for journalists. We are established the trade union under Registrar of Trade Union Act 1959. So every occupation or every industry also, they have the right to form the trade union.
Does the union serve all journalists in Malaysia, or does a journalist have to become a member of the union to be covered?
We are registered under the name of Peninsula Malaysia. That's why we also restricted due to our constitution. Our membership is only within the peninsula, so we cannot expand it to Sabah and Sarawak. To my knowledge, Sabah, Sarawak, because they have, how to say, the autonomy themselves for the government. That's why they are not allowed any trade union body from the peninsula to enter their region.
But what about when it comes to journalists? Do they have to be members of the union before they are covered?
But for being a journalist, you're not necessary to join NUJ, because you have the right to choose whether you want to join and do not want to join. Basically, it's free. But all the journalists are covered if they join in as a member. NUJ has been established since 1962. That's why at that time, the new media haven't come out yet. So in our constitution, the definition for journalists only refer to the print media. So that's why in order to recruit the online media right now, NUJ also have followed the step which is required by the Registrar of Trade Union. So we have to amend our constitution. And finally, this amendment has been done 2 years ago. So we can actually starting to recruit the online media, but with one condition. The government wants those who have the media pass issued by the Ministry of Communication and Multimedia, then only defined as the professional journalist. Doesn't include those stringer or bloggers.
So you need to have the actual media card before...
Yes, because then somebody claimed they work at home, they're, I'm the journalist.
So you need to be an official journalist with
the official
media card before can be covered or before you can join the union?
Both.
What rights do Malaysian journalists have with regard to employment?
The basic rights, like everything which is stated in Employment Act 1955, is just like your annual leave. You at least have 8 days. The company cannot give below 8 days for you in calendar year. But then, as a union, we play our role as every 3 years, we have to revise our collective agreement. So this is the main task for the trade union. And through this collective agreement, we negotiate with the employer in order to review everything which is written in the collective agreement.
From your experience being in the NUJ, do employers in Malaysia observe this basic rights accorded to journalists?
To my knowledge, at this moment, we are glad that all the employers quite cooperate with us. And as I know, there's only one Chinese newspaper organization at the moment, they disregard the basic right of the employee. I mean, beside that, the rest of the newspaper establishment, their companies, they all comply with what have the country law.
So you mentioned that there is one news organization that has not complied. What would the NUJ do, or what has the NUJ done?
Okay, unfortunately, that organization, the employer didn't join in as a member, so they are not our members, so we cannot do anything at the moment. But what we can convey the message is I try to get connected with the employee as well, and then ask them and then invite them to form the union there. They can join in as the umbrella of NUJ, but then at least the first step, you have to form the branch with 11 committee members. But then, because I don't know what reason, but most of the employees or the members, they could be afraid. They think that by joining the union, you're fighting with your employer, with the boss. So it could be some kind of a traditional concept.
What are the issues journalists often come to the NUJ for?
For the complaint that we received from the members during the so many years in the past, case of dismissal, or some of the member, it could be incorporate transferring. Just like you work in KL, but suddenly your boss asks you to transfer to other state. So this one, if according to the law, we want to make sure the transferring is on schedule and follow the law. And then just like the members, their salary cannot be reduced. Must make sure the particular person get his wage and salary equal.
What about things like wrongful termination?
Okay, yeah, of course, wrongful termination. Then the union could, after hearing from the both party, usually if this kind of thing happen, the union will request the company to have the DI, you know, the domestic inquiry. And then the company cannot say no. And then after the DI, the company will find some excuses and he will list down the reason why she should dismiss some people. But then if the member feel that he is innocent or he didn't done anything wrong, so we still could proceed the case. We can make our complaint to the third party. That means the Industry Relations Department is under the Human Resource Ministry. So that is the only way that we could forward the case, prolong the case to that authority. And then from there, if the IRD officer, they will do the mediation. If the mediation fail, the case also can refer, I mean, at last, up to the minister. We refer to the minister to decide whether it should bring it to the industrial court or not.
Okay. So is it safe to say that the NUJ kind of plays mediator between the employee and employer?
Yeah. Yes, face-to-face, yeah.
Okay. So, you know, do journalists have other avenues they can go to? Maybe if it's something that a journalist should consult a lawyer about, will the NUJ help them?
Yeah. Because we are the union who protect them. Then they are our members. Of course, we will cover the legal fees. If you're not a member, if something happens, I mean, if you face some problem, then you have to find your own lawyer with your own expenses. But then, of course, we will study the case first. And then if there is the need, then we will consult our lawyer and then we will see what kind of step we're going to take in the next.
Let's talk about retrenchment. There have been a number of cases where journalists have been unfairly retrenched.
Yes.
For example, the Rakyat Post earlier this year, it ceased operation when it was under its former management. Now, the Rakyat Post, it told its employees that they would have to lodge a complaint with the Labour Department or seek industrial action in order for them to get their 2 months unpaid salary.
Oh, I see.
So, did the employees consult with the NUJ?
No, unfortunately, no, because just like what I tell you, because they are not our member yet. Of course, we welcome them to consult us for our opinion, but then in a practical way, we cannot help them. We can only give consultation, but then we cannot help them to file the case. This is because we are not our member. Because nowadays, a lot of young generation, they thought that if they choose the right company and then the company benefit is quite stable, financial, no problem, then they're staying okay. So they think this kind of thing wouldn't happen to them. But this union, just like the insurance coverage for you, just in case when something happens, the union will protect you.
So in a case of retrenchment like this, with what happened to the employees of the Rakyat Post, what would the NUJ recommend to do if, for instance, employees from the Rakyat Post are part of the union?
To my knowledge, if they don't have the collective agreement between the two parties, I mean the employer and employees, then it must refer to their contract. You will see what the contract say. But of course, for retrenchment, if under this Employment Act 1955, they must follow to make sure the employer, the company, have to follow the law, give the full payment or whatever according to the seniority of each staff. So that's why we only can advise them to look at the law to make sure the company or the employer pay them in full. If not, they can lodge the complaint to the labor authority or labor department.
This is basically a right that all employees have then.
Yes, yes, yes.
As a union, what is your relationship like with media companies?
This is a tough question. Actually, the two characters is a conflict, but it's up to you how to handle it. Because I myself, I'm the staff of this company. I work for Sinchu. And at the same time, I'm also the president for NUJ. But then, because most of the time, the stand of the union and with the company is it cannot be equal, right? It cannot be same. That's why the company, if they have their own way of thinking, and then for union side, we have our anger. That's why we cannot reach to one consensus for certain issues. Every 3 years, we're going to review our collective agreement. During the negotiation, we're going to put on our proposal and ask the employer or the company to increase our salary, like by how many percent. But then, of course, the company also, they will do their counter offer. There's certain issue we cannot reach consensus. But to me, I think I will put the question on the table. Right? And then in private, we still can be a friend with my boss. Of course, they're not going to be my enemy anyway. We're just playing our role for each party. That's it.
Are there countries in Southeast Asia which we as Malaysians can use as a yardstick to compare with?
If we compare within our ASEAN, I think Malaysia, the journalist income is pretty good so far, If compared to Indonesia, of course, we don't want to compare to Singapore or Brunei because of due to the currency, but if compared to Thailand, Indonesia, Cambodia, then we are the best among those countries. We are the higher.
Next, I spoke to Ram Anand from the Institute of Journalists, or more fondly known as IOJ, a body that tries to promote greater standards of journalism. While issues like these might not be under their direct purview, they do have opinions on the matter.
Okay, IOJ is basically what we try to act as an association, sort of like an institute to set greater standards of journalism and to promote dialogues and conversation among the different media groups that we have in the country, to promote greater standards. What we try to do is that, first of all, we feel there is not enough conversation among the various media groups. I'm talking about mainstream and then non-mainstream, online, broadcast and all these different areas. So what we try to do is to try to bring everyone on the same table and try to get a conversation going as to how we are going to a common standard for all of us in journalism, because that is something I think in Malaysia we lack unified movement to sort of promote how can we better ourselves as an industry, to act as a check and balance for ourselves instead of, you know, needing external organizations trying to dictate our ethics and all of that.
Based on IOJ's observation, do you think employers in Malaysia observe the employees' rights when it comes to how journalists are treated?
I do not know how to make a general comment on that, but there have been cases of dispute and all of that, which is a bit, least to say, disappointing, because there are certain organizations that, you know, sort of have not looked after the welfare of journalists and all of that. But we believe, the welfare of journalists is just as important as the welfare of any other industry.
How does IOJ help journalists when it comes to issues such as retrenchment or unpaid salaries?
Unpaid salaries, retrenchment, basically the media groups, several media groups actually, there's Rakan Media, Maharashtram, and then there's the Foreign Correspondents Club of Malaysia, FCCM. We have set up a job repository for journalists who are out of work. So that initiative came about after the Malaysian Insider was shut down, but it basically applies across the board for any journalist who are basically looking for a job and suddenly lost their job. So we pool all our sort of contacts and resources together to basically allow people to advertise job openings on our repository. Not strictly journalism jobs, but media-related jobs. Those are the least things that we can do to sort of, you know, just ensure that our fellow colleagues are in gainful employment all the time.
It is often said that journalism is a vocation that is more about the cost and the end goal and not the reward. So, in your opinion, has this saying been used to, in a way, justify mistreatment of employees?
I don't think I've heard it being used to justify any mistreatment, but then again, it is also, people tend to see journalists as being, you know, like you said, we working for a cause, but the fact is we also are just basic, you know, employees of a particular organization and all of that. So basic welfare is also important, you know, but you're working for a salary as well. So those things have to be kept in mind. I mean, certain basic things need to be there, just the same as any other company would employ any other person of skill.
People have said that journalism is a low-paying job and you need to know what you're getting into if you're going into journalism. So do you think this is a fair assessment to be made?
Well, it is quite a fair assessment. I mean, to say we are a low-paying job, of course, relative to a lot of other industries, journalism does not pay handsomely. So people who come into this industry, sometimes they are quite aware of what they are getting. But at the same time, it does not mean that it's all about the cost and not about the welfare. So the welfare is also important. In relatively, it might be a lower-paying job compared to other industries. So because of that, it's even more important to ensure that the welfare of journalists, the basic welfare, is always taken care of.
Yeah, because that's the thing. When people talk about journalists' rights, they tend to talk about censorship and the freedom of the media as opposed to their economic welfare. So why do you think this is the case?
I think that is because I would say that we see the root cause as having come from censorship and freedom of the media. Just like any other industry, if we have enough freedom of the media in this country, more news organizations are bound to thrive. And when media organizations thrive, there will be more job opportunities. We will be looking at a bigger media landscape than the one that we are looking at right now. We have seen the advent of the online media, I mean social media and all of that, but I think it's still very limited when you look at more advanced democracies. So it's about taking away those restrictions to allow the particular industry itself to flourish. And when it flourishes, then there will be more job opportunities, and chances are journalists will have, you know, plenty of options and job opportunities, and their welfare will be better taken care of. So we look at that as being the root cause that, you know, causes this unwanted events of like journalists losing jobs and their welfare not being taken care of, because it all comes down to financial capacities of these organizations end of the day.
Do you think the industry itself is a problem in the sense where, because the industry is not thriving, that's why you have cases where, you know, there are unfair retrenchment and...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what we believe in, because when you open up the landscape and when the industry is actually thriving, then, of course, the companies are likely to expand and not retrench at a time like this. So now what we are seeing is that companies are closing down because of financial restrictions and the inability to perform financially. But this in turn, of course, the final end is always the journalist's job at stake. So when they downsize or when they decide to close down, then it is their jobs that comes at stake for this kind of thing.
Is it fair to say that when it comes to issues of journalist rights, it doesn't gain enough traction compared to issues such as, again, the freedom of the media and also censorship?
Of course, it does not gain enough traction, but I think one can't exist without the other. We have to sort of, I mean, we cannot just look at, otherwise you'll be looking at every case as an isolated case. If something happens, say, in this X company, then you'll be talking about, you know, how that company could have taken care of the welfare of the journalists better or what they should be doing better. But at most, we are always looking at isolated cases. If you're looking at the bigger picture, then it always boils down to, you know, the landscape itself and the industry itself as a whole. How are we doing? I mean, we've always seen this kind of things. Actually, I don't say it's a one-off. There's a lot of news organizations that opens and then closes down in a year or two. The landscape, the political and the media landscape is constantly given way for such things to happen. And when it's so volatile, you're talking about the job of journalists itself being volatile. There's not enough, I would say, security for these jobs, except maybe a few mainstream organizations.
That was Ram Anand from the Institute of Journalists, and earlier you heard from Chin Sung Chiu, the president of the National Union of Journalists, Peninsula Malaysia. This morning's show was produced by Hanif Bahruddin and me, Cheryl Kuo.
I hope it's been food for thought, and remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is, in case you missed it, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.